My name is Penny Haggerty. I am 47 years old. Today is April 4th, and I am speaking with Chuck Peters, who is my father. We are recording an interview in my house in Winchester, Virginia. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Pen.
Dad, what do you feel most grateful for in your life?
Probably the love of Penny's mom, Georgina Chamberlain, and my three kids, although truth be told, from time to time they vex me.
Okay. What are some of the most important lessons you've learned in life, and how did you learn them?
I think probably most important lesson I learned in life was duty, doing your duty, even if it's unpleasant. I learned that very early from my parents, and then had it reinforced when I served in the Marine Corps. I do things I don't really want to do out of a sense of duty, and I try to do them cheerfully, even when I don't want to do them.
Can you give me an example of one of the early lessons in duty that you learned?
Well, one of the early lessons I learned was when I was in the sixth grade. My father got me a job on a bread truck, which meant that on Saturday, the day most kids like to sleep in, I had to get up at 6 o'clock. And ride on a bread truck until 4 o'clock in the afternoon, delivering bread to various, mostly stores, but also to the poor house in my rural county in Ohio. And to, and I remember this, this really took duty, poor old woman who was living alone and obviously never bathed, and we would take her 2 loaves of bread, which was supposed to last her for the week, but that house had such an odor of old age about it that I remember it unfondly.
Did he make you take the job to help out around the house?
He made me take the job because I had a penchant for sleeping a lot, and he wanted to ensure that I get up and get out and do things.
So you got to keep whatever money you earned, or did it go into the family?
No, it did not go into the family. My family and our town was comparatively well off, not the top of the bracket, but comparatively well off compared to a lot of my friends. No, I spent that buck on Saturday night. It was out of my pocket by Sunday morning at the local, we called it Youth Harbor, where it was a teenage hangout that the city ran to keep kids off the street.
Can you describe one of your happiest memories?
Well, obviously one of my happiest was the day I got married. Another happy day was when I got commissioned in the Marine Corps after coming very close to flunking out of officer school and making it. Those were, in fact, as a matter of fact, within a year of each other, and they were very, very happy.
And so what year was that?
Got married in July of 57 and got commissioned in, got to keep my commission in September of 56.
So that was a highlight of your, that little period of
life. Oh, yeah,
life.
That was probably the highlight. And then 59, our first son was born, actually, that wasn't as happy because we were really strapped for cash, but we were really glad to have him come aboard.
Sorry. What are you proudest of, and what does this do to make you feel proud?
Probably what I am proudest of, beyond the usual generic things of children, that sort of thing, I was involved in the very early efforts to help the mentally retarded, the mentally ill. In fact, a local United Way in Pittsburgh honored me about a year ago and labeled me a pioneer. I think they think I discovered mental retardation. But as various positions I held, we closed several very, very bad residential facilities. I was involved in the right to education, which is now the national, was in Pennsylvania, is now the national law. Those are major accomplishments in my life.
When you say you were involved with the right to education, what do you mean?
The law in Pennsylvania and in most states said that parents did not have to start their children to school until age 8, and students could, with their parents' permission, withdraw at age 16. But most school districts interpreted that law to mean they did not have to take a child until age 8, so they didn't take mentally retarded, well, the more severely mentally retarded, into school until age 8. And if you did get in and were labeled mentally retarded, by and large, you were forced out. It wasn't your choice at age 16. So after we won federal court actions, the choice to start a kid until age 8 was the parents, not the school. If the kid was supposed to be in school, they had to provide. And the young man or young woman was allowed to stay in school until age 21. And that became the law in Pennsylvania and pretty much across the country.
So you became an advocate for the parents and the students, and did you sue the state on their behalf? Is that how that happened?
The answer to the question is, did we litigate it? And yes, and we litigated it in federal court. I helped select the class of students, and it was a class action in western Pennsylvania. But we made a practice of suing the state. You got to understand, this was the period in the mid-60s when there was a lot of unrest in the country, and everybody was going on the street with signs or into court. And I conceived of the mentally retarded as just another disenfranchised minority, and took moves from the Civil Rights Playbook, court, street picketing, the whole thing.
So that's how you conceived of the idea of suing, of going with
We sure had examples. We certainly had examples. This was during, the Vietnam War, and a lot of people were suing the government.
So do you think if the civil rights movement had not been going on at that same time, or had not sort of paved the way, do you think that your movement for rights for the intellectually disabled would have taken longer, or do you think you would have had to take a different route?
The movement, by and large, they were parents of the middle class and even the upper middle class. So they're not the kind of people who regularly take to the street or take to the court. I think if it hadn't been the example of the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, they would not be nearly as aggressive as they were. Would it have taken another path? It already was taking another path before that. They had faith in the system in the fact that they could change it by making nice, and obviously they had not had much success. The whole thing, the whole movement for advocacy for the mentally ill and the mentally retarded didn't really get started until maybe 10, 15 years before that, and it wasn't going very, very far any place at that point.
What was the catalyst for to change the status quo with how we treat our most vulnerable citizens?
I'm sorry, I asked a question.
So you said that there wasn't really anything except until about 10 years before that.
10 or 15 so years before.
What was the catalyst?
Oh,
what,
okay. One of the big catalysts, and people forget this, is during World War II, a lot of conscientious objectors worked off their service in institutions, and they saw how bad the institutions were. A lot of them were Quakers. That was a lot of the initial push earlier on. Up until then, parents who had a retarded child, and that's where I started in the MR movement, and it was a movement. It used to be that literally would keep the kid in their house. They would never go out. They would never go to school. I had an aunt and a cousin, women, both of whom were mentally retarded, and both, and let me hasten to say, this did not in any way influence me getting involved in the biz, but they were pretty much housebound, because parents tended to be ashamed of their mentally challenged or mentally ill child.
Is there anything else you'd like to add to this that you think we haven't covered?
No, I think we pretty well covered it.
All right. Would you like to tell me about one of your most difficult memories? And you don't have to.
Sure. Probably the most difficult moment was there were probably two. After I got out of the Marines, Georgie and I and our newborn Chip, I think he was maybe 3 months old at the oldest, moved to Louisville, Kentucky, working for a company. I was a traveling salesman, a peddler. I had the whole state of Kentucky and the southern two-thirds of Indiana to cover. Anyway, long story short, back at the ranch, back at the headquarters in McKees Rocks, PA, there was a palace coup, and of the all the new salesmen who had been hired, which I was one, got fired, and they got fired because the guy who hired us got fired, and they just fired his whole team, except for one of the guys who had had enough sense to get engaged to the president of the company's daughter. And since I was already married, that wasn't an option for me. Anyway, flew down and said, you're fired. And very briefly, we had to then pack up all of our stuff in a trailer, and we had two cars, a 36 Dodge and a station wagon that I had to trade a sports car in on to haul my samples. And then we made a big epic retreat back to Pittsburgh. That was a very difficult time. I was young then, and it was probably a big adventure, looking back on it, but at the time it was not very pleasant. I have another one.
Okay.
Other one, the young woman who's now interviewing me had a very difficult birth. and we were very concerned that her mom or her or both might die. At that point, we were living in New Hampshire. They talk about support systems. We didn't know hardly anybody. We moved there in first of July, as a matter of fact, and she was born the end of August. It was a very, very scary, very difficult time.
You want to talk more about that?
Don't you remember it?
I believe I was being born, so I don't remember all the details.
She was born the night that the Boston Red Sox beat the, I don't remember who they beat, but Yablonski, I think it was, knocked the home run, and she came into the world just as the crowd in Boston was cheering for that home run, and the nurses all cheered too, but Georgie could never figure out whether it was for her or for the home run.
So what was so difficult about the birth? Why were we both in danger?
Well, that's probably more science than I'm capable of, but essentially Georgie went into labor. Then the labor stopped. They actually sent her home from the hospital. The infant, who's now interviewing me, pulled away from the placenta and for maybe a month had not received much nourishment. And the pediatrician was so concerned that he actually was in the operating room for the delivery and must have done a good job because she's here. She's beautiful. She has two beautiful kids of her own and is a marvelous teacher.
Thanks, Dad. How would you like to be remembered?
How would I like to be remembered? I probably as a good human being who did not flinch and did not falter too often. Anybody that says they never flinched or never faltered, I'd like to remember as a good human being who did not flinch or falter too often.
All right. How would you like, well, I believe that that's of a generic, how you want the public to remember you. How would you like your children to remember you?
As a good human being, a guy who tried to be a good father, knows, looking back now, the lady interviewing me is 46. My two boys are over 50, so I'm going to be 82 in August of 2015. And looking back, I would like my kids to remember me as a guy who tried very, very hard to be a good father. Probably did not do as good a job as he would like to have, but always tried to do it with some level of good humor.
You accomplished all of that.
My daughter has learned from me, and she is full of blarney.
How would you like your grandchildren to remember you?
As their fun grandfather.
Do you remember any songs that you used to sing besides the Marine Corps hymn? Although we would love to hear it. Anything?
The first song that I think that I can actually remember. It was a song that came out about a week after December 1941, Let's Remember Pearl Harbor, I think is actually the first song that I can remember. But I can remember another song called Mersey Doats and Dozy Doats from my childhood.
Okay, let's hear the Pearl Harbor.
Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we do the Alamo. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. We'll always remember that day of infamy. Let's remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory.
That was very good.
You are full of blarney, but thank you.
What about the songs you used to sing with Uncle Bud? Like, I don't want to join the army.
Well, that was...
Did that come after what?
That was actually a song I learned at Quantico. It was an old English music hall song.
Okay. How does that song go?
Well, you know that song, too.
I'll help you when I remember the words.
Okay.
I don't want to join the army.
I don't want to go to war. I'd rather hang around Piccadilly Underground. Live enough the earnings of a high-born lady. Don't want a bullet in me shoulder. Don't want me arse shot away. Oh, I'd rather be in England, in jolly, jolly England. I'll fornicate my blooming life away. Gore blimey, call out the army and the navy. Call out the rank and the file. Call out the bloody territorials. They'll face danger with a smile. Gore blimey, oh, you can call on me mither, me sister and me brother, but for God's sakes, don't call me.
How about You Are My Sunshine? Because you used to sing that a lot when we were traveling in the car.
You sing You Are My Sunshine, and On Top of Old Smokey was another one that we sang a lot. But people know those songs, so I don't think we need to sing them.
Do you want to sing any of your old Irish sea chanties that people might not know?
I don't think there's any that people don't know any that they know. I learned same way they did from the chieftains and other groups.
Well,
but speaking of sea chanties, why don't you ask me about adventures on our boat, the Bedlam one?
I think that's going to be a whole nother interview. That interview takes, all right. Because we're almost halfway through this interview, That interview is a whole nother thing.
Okay. So what else?
All right, hold on. Can you tell me about any lessons you learned from your relationships? Do you have any wisdom to pass on to your children and your grandchildren about love?
Never confuse lust with love. That will get you in more trouble and quicker than most anything else. Embrace people. It took me a long time to learn this. I learned this from a guy that I worked with who, when I first met him, would engage people, total strangers, in elevators. And it used to embarrass me to be with him when he did that. And I found out that A, it was fun, and B, you meet a lot of interesting people. So if there is any possible opening to engage somebody in conversation, I endeavor to do it, and I learn a lot by doing that.
Do you believe in forgiveness?
Do I believe in forgiveness? As I've gotten older, I believe in it more and more. When I was young, I certainly didn't. I believed more in revenge than I did in forgiveness. But as I've gotten older, the short answer, I guess, would be yes, I do.
Do you regret going toward revenge rather than forgiveness in your relationships?
No, I don't. The Queen Mum hated... What was her name that married the...
Diana?
No.
Wallace Simpson.
Hated Wallace Simpson. And she hated her because she felt that the reason her husband became king, which he didn't want to do and she didn't want to be queen, was because of Wallace. So when Wallace's husband, who abdicated as king, died, it was necessary to invite Wallace back to the palace for the funeral. And the Queen Mum said something like, see how she say this? She said, we were young, we felt more strongly about things and disliked people who had wronged us. I'm really screwing this up. But as we grow older, we care less. And that's a pity. And that's the way I feel about revenge. It's a pity I don't feel that emotion anymore, because I always felt good when I thought I was going to stick it to somebody who had stuck it to me.
Okay, thank you. When you were a little kid.
Okay.
What did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
One of my absolute earliest memories, this is strange, was when the Germans invaded Poland in September 1939, and I was born in 33, so I was 6 years old. Did I do that math right?
You're not asking the right person. I'm genetically related to you.
I think I was six, yeah. Anyway, my little friends, we all got together and had a parade up and down the alley and back of our houses in Wellsville, Ohio. And the next big thing was that I remember was Pearl Harbor. And I guess I always thought, always wanted to grow up to be a soldier, ultimately to be a Marine. That's what I thought I was going to be. And I seriously considered making a career out of it.
Why didn't you?
Why didn't I? I think in order to be a good officer of Marines, you've got to have a sharper focus than I did. You've got to be, and I don't mean this in a negative sense, you've got to be more constipated than I was, more buttoned down.
More less organized?
Probably more organized, less imaginative. So that's probably why I...
You mean like more play by the book? You're not necessarily a play by the book kind of guy.
That was it. I recently had wrote to get all of my fitness reports. And one fitness report had 2 pages of addendums, literally, saying how I could walk on water and how great I was. And another one said, this officer requires close supervision. So that's probably why I didn't make a career out of it.
All right. And here is our last question. If you could name one person in your life who has been kindest to you, who was that person, or who is that person, and why would you name them as the kindest?
Probably the person who was kindest, most forgiving, was my wife, Georgina. I don't think she realized what a schmuck she was marrying, and then adjusted to it, and then helped me to change. She's the one that taught me how to say I love you and to love. If I had to make a second choice, it would have been my grandfather, who died when I was 9. I lived next door to him, and he doted on me because I was named after him, and he was exceptionally kind to me.
Thank you for taking this time for this first installment of Talks with Dad. Mm-hmm. I love you, Dad.
Thank you.